informative radio for the Sunshine State.
Looking for car shows? Then look no further than flacarshows.com. On your computer or on your mobile device, flacarshows.com is a comprehensive list of automotive events, plus videos and news articles. Whether you're looking for car shows, cruise-ins, meetups, automotive festivals, cars and coffees, or anything else relating to an internal combustion engine, then this is a site for you. Check it out online or on your phone at flacarshows.com.
You may be owed some money. After 911 and 411, call 541. That's 727-541-1741. Call Gulfstream Motorsports for a diminished value report. Due to my 28 years experience in the auto salvage business, I'm very good with wrecks. So if your car's been involved in a wreck, call me for a diminished value report. Call 727-541-1741. You may be owed some money for the lost value of your repaired vehicle. And visit us at GulfstreamMotorsports.com.
The New York Yacht Club were ferocious defenders of the America's Cup. They oozed style, wealth, this unbeatableness.
The U.S. had never lost. It was the longest winning streak in sporting history for 132 years.
There's no question the emerging force was Dennis Conner.
That was the best sailor in the world.
He will do anything to win.
Are we slaughtering him?
3, 2, 1.
It was time that we had to do something radical.
It's a huge commitment.
We had to believe ourselves that we belong on the world stage.
I hadn't been the navigator on any boat.
But we were there for one reason, to win.
All the work that we had done had paid huge dividends. We came out all guns blazing.
What Australians really like is upsetting the upper echelon.
The whole of the world was watching this.
The greatest yacht race of the century.
I've never seen anything like this.
And a little country called Australia had the audacity to think that we could do it.
And now...
Hey, Rocky, watch me pull a rabbit out of my hat.
Again?
Button up my sleeve. Presto! No doubt about it. I gotta get another hat.
Now here's something we hope you'll really like.
Hi everybody, it's Derek Bell, the 5-time Le Mans winner, 3-time Daytona 24-hour winner, 2-time World Sports Car Champion. You're listening to Nostalgic Radio and Cars.
Okay, listeners, welcome. You're tuned in to Nostalgic Radio and Cars, and I'm your show host, Robert. Run your computers and Google Tantalk1340.com, and you can see us live here in the studios in downtown Clearwater. Don't forget to check out our website, GulfstreamMotorsports.com, where you can find out all about us. And if you want to listen to 712 shows going into our 15th year officially now, live on the air, don't forget to check out NostalgicRadioandCars.com. Again, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Boys and girls, car guys, car gals, motorcycle girls, motorcycle gals, and boating sportsmen and sportswomen. We got a great show for you tonight. We got a special guest coming on. We're going to be talking a little bit about sailing and, of course, race cars, and maybe doing a little comparison. So what we're going to do right now is we're going to fire up the stereo, we're going to play a little music, and we're going to come back with our special guest. So don't touch that dial. We'll be right back.
Out of town on a boat from the southern islands, sailing to reach before a following sea. She was making for the trades on the outside and the downhill run to Papeete. Off the wind on this heading lie the Marquesas. Got 80 feet of a water line, nicely making way in a noisy bar in Avalon. I tried to call you, but on a midnight watch I realized why twice you ran away. Think about
how many times I had fallen. Spirits are using me
Southern Cross for the first time. You understand now why you came this way. 'Cause the truth you might be running from is so small, but it's as big as the promise of a coming day. So I'm sailing for tomorrow, my dreams are a-dying, and my love is an anchor tied to you,
tied with a silver chain.
I have my ship and all the flags are a-flying. She is all that I have left,
and music is her name.
Think about
how many.
All right, guys, we're back, and you're tuned into Nostalgic Radio and Cars, and it's time to introduce our special guests for the evening. Now, we don't cover sailing very often, but this evening we will be talking about sailing, and I'm delighted to welcome to the show this evening a gentleman I met at Road Atlanta who's also into vintage road racing, but this gentleman is a former Olympic sailor and America's Cup sailor. I'm delighted to welcome to the show this evening, Jerry Richard. Jerry, how are you?
I'm very good, Robert. Thanks. It's a real pleasure to talk to you. It's fun catching up with you at Road Atlanta at the HSR Walter Mitty, and I really appreciated you coming over and checking out my very unusual race car.
Well, now, that's actually kind of what precipitated this whole kind of relationship, because you had a very, very interesting MGB GT, but it also had something real interesting. It wasn't just your basic four-cylinder or modified six. It was a V8. So why don't you talk a little bit about that, and then we'll get into sailing here in a little bit.
Well, a lot of people have had MGBs, their dads had them, their grandfathers had them, whatever. So it does draw a lot of attention. But in England, between, when was it, 1973 to 1975, they made 2,500 MGB GTs, which is the hardtop version, with basically the Range Rover all-aluminum V8 engine. But unfortunately, they tried to get them homologated or whatever the word is so they could have them here in America. And they sent seven over and they couldn't get them to pass. So they shipped them all back to England. So that car was never officially for sale over here in the US. Many people have heard about them. Many haven't. Often at the racetrack, you'll get people come up and say, oh, they never made a V8. You know, what have you got here? And well, actually, they did. And the people that really know, the Range Rover motor was the original sort of 1962 Buick 215 all aluminum motor. Buick ditched that motor and Rover in England bought it.
Interesting. I wonder why they did that. Was that to facilitate a need for a V8 motor for the Range Rover, you think? Because they were, what, four cylinders and diesels before that? And I think they had a straight six also, right?
British Leyland did. The Range Rover actually was always a V8. When it was introduced, it was really an upgrade farmyard vehicle. It was never the luxury vehicle that you see now. They literally, you know, plastic seats, the hinges were up for the doors were on the outside, and it was just a slightly upgraded Land Rover, and they've come a long way since then. But that engine has been used in Morgans in England, in British cars, TVR, really, you know, nice sports cars, Triumph TR8. It's been in all sorts of cars, and obviously the MGB GT V8. I have two of the cars. The one you saw was one I built here in America 20 years ago. But I still have my original, well, I bought it for the road. It's a 1974 MGB GT V8, and it was sitting around at home. I've owned the car 42 years and always wanted to go car racing. One day I just decided, you know what? There's a series for the MGs. It's called the BC V8 Championship, which is run by the MG Car Club. And I got the rules, had never seen the racing, built the car, and spent the last, you know, 30-odd years trying to make them go faster. It's been a fun time. I've met so many people who've had interest in the car. We first brought the car over to race in the SVRA series. They were very keen to have the car. In fact, when the car came over, when I could afford eventually to bring it over, that was in 1999, there's a quite a well-known race car driver back in the day. His name was Warwick Banks in England. And he raced for a small team called Tyrrell, Ken Tyrrell. And at the time, he raced Formula 3 with a very known now race car driver, Jackie Stewart. So I met Warwick. We were racing at Brands Hatch. I was very new to racing, and I was rubbish. But anyway, Warwick, I think Warwick was probably lapping me in his MG. I'd built the car myself, and I hadn't taken the rear bump stops, you know, for the suspension off the car, the rubber bump stops. And I hit the chicane, taking the curb. The car landed on a bump stop and turned immediately right, straight into the crash barrier. And Warwick was the gentleman behind me. Anyway, a few races later, I was planning to move to America, and Warwick was at the race. And he said, so what are you going to do with the car? And I said, well, I'm just going to leave it with a friend of mine on the farms. He said, well, why don't you leave it with me and I'll race it? And, you know, if I crash it, I'll fix it, which he did. Anyway, when I decided to bring the car over, Jack Worley, the technical director of SVRA at the time, said, well, why don't we get Warwick Banks to come over? He can do a talk at Watkins Glen. SVRA have a race called the Collier Cup, which, you know, people may not know, but the Collier brothers were very famous racers, and they raced MGs. So there's a trophy called the Collier Cup. Warwick came over, raced the car. And since then, six or seven people have built these V8 MGs, and we race them in, you know, the vintage racing in various places around the country.
Your car had a real interesting induction system on it. Tell the listeners a little bit about it, because I saw it. I was pretty impressed with it. But it's like, if I remember correctly, kind of like a crossover. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so it's not quite a crossover. It sort of looks that way. So we have, so it's a V8 engine, and we have four side draft Weber carburetors on them. They happen to be size 48s, but the manifolds are what they call swan neck manifolds. So they come from the intake, which is down the center of the engine, both sides, just like a regular V8, and then they swing up, just a little up, and actually over the valve covers on the same side. So if you're looking at the left side carburetors, They come from the left side of the engine, swing up over the valve covers, and then the carburetors are right there. That system was developed in England for the rally cars, the TR8 rally cars, and one of those did come over here and race a little bit. And they're like that, so you can have longer runners for the intake, which people say give you more torque. And for a rally car, that's important. So there aren't many of them around. You can actually buy them still new. And I've seen one or two people with them on Facebook, but I've never actually seen them on a car anywhere.
So your car is the only one that actually has a real live set on it?
Well, as I know in England, you know, hard to say that, but here in America, I would say, yes, that's correct. And I'm sure if anybody has them out there, I'd love to know, because I'm always trying to find, you know, people who have V8 MGs, especially if they were ever wanting to race them, because, you know, we like to get together and, you know, and have a fun time and run the cars together. Beat up on the Porsches a little bit.
Oh, yeah, got to do that for sure. So let me ask you a question. So I actually have the picture pulled up here, and I wish my listeners could see this, because this is a stunning car. So I'm looking at the engine. Now, what is the actual displacement of that motor?
Well, that's a good question. Just real quick. Back in England, we ran it with a 4.2-liter engine. But when I came to America with the car in 1999, there wasn't really a class for it to fit, because SCCA racing, which vintage racing is or was based on, and the cars here, if you had a TR8, and you raced, it had to run with the original 3.5-liter engine. So when my engine blew up here, the technical guys said, well, if you really want to race vintage, then put the 3.5-liter engine in. You know, that's the original size. Put skinnier wheels on it. You know, we don't allow big wheels like that over here in America. And take all the fiberglass lightweight panels off and put the metal ones back on. So I had to make a lot of changes. So I raced with a 3.5-liter engine for 20 years here. And then, you know, I'm an older gentleman now, and I'm just looking to finish up my racing. And I always wanted to race the car as I raced it in England. So I went to HSR, to the technical director, and said, you know, I'd really like to, you know, do something a little bit different in the final years. You've got the rules as we race the car in England. is there some way you can fit me into another class in HSR? And so I've moved from group three to group five. I'm still sorting the car, and I've gone from a 3.5 litre engine to a 4.6 litre. And you may not think that's a big deal, but the big restriction on these little engines is the size of the bores and the valves. So if you have a small bore, you can't get very big valves in these particular heads. The design of the heads is terrible. The valves are offset to one side of the heads, so you can't get the maximum size valves that you would in a Chevrolet or a Ford, as an example. So very restrictive. So the bigger the bore, the better. And I have to say, it's made a difference. I'm still sorting the car out. I've been away from racing for 8 years, and I've just started back fairly recently. And you know, the extra 100 horsepower is, it's making a difference for sure. I'm loving it.
Excellent. Now, I want to digress for a second, because I know you got this car, which has got some serious fender flares, some very wide tires and wheels on it. And then you have a stock MGB GT, and the GT to me is just cool. It's just a, I mean, the Roadster is a neat looking car, but the GT just, I don't know, it's got that poor man Aston Martin look to it, but still, it's a stylish car, I think. And I'm going to say this because you were over there at the time. Wasn't an MGB GT a relatively trendy car back in the day?
Oh, it was. Prince Charles had one, and Princess Anne had one. You know, a lot of rock stars had them. Famous footballer George Best, and the audience probably don't know who he is, but he was a top soccer player for Manchester United. And so it was sort of a call. It wasn't an Aston Martin, it wasn't an E-type Jag, but the price wasn't there either. And they're still very sought after. You know, they haven't gone up in value like a lot of cars. I guess that's because they made so many of them. But and the other nice thing is you can buy every single part for an MGB or an MGB GT. When the factory closed, they sold all the molds, and there's companies in England that reproduce all the parts. So it's just a fun car. It was never a car I really had an affiliation with. My dad one day said to me, he said, hey, there's a, I'd had a couple of MGs, and he said, there's a V8 MG up the road here for sale. Why don't you come and look at it? And in England, a V8 engine meant nothing back then. It was just different. Nobody really knew much about them because hardly any cars had them. We all had four-cylinder or six-cylinder engines and, you know, much smaller bore. Anyway, I went along. I enjoyed the ride. It was different. And like I mentioned earlier, I still have that car 42 years later.
Wow. We got on a subject because I told you I was looking for an MGC hood. And did I understand you correctly? You have an MGC as well, GT?
Yes. I have an MGC, which, I've had it for 20-odd years, and I'm building it into what they call a Sebring replica.
Uh-huh.
MG, when they introduced the C, which is a six-cylinder car, they built six cars ahead of time. They had aluminum panels on, and they really built them to be race cars. Well, they built two of them, and they raced those cars. It would have been around the late 60s. 1969, they raced them at Sebring in the 12-hour race. And those are the arches, the wheel fenders that you see on my car. In England, we're only allowed as a race car to do whatever the factory did. So those fenders, the factory fitted those fenders. They also fitted much taller shock absorbers in the back of the car on the MGC. So we were allowed to do that. Now, you may have noticed on my car that the headers, the exhaust pipes, go through the inner fenders. Well, originally, we weren't allowed to do that because the MGB GT V8 didn't come with headers that went through the fenders. They were called block huggers. They were really tight to the block, terrible for breathing on the motor. But in 1982, they introduced a car called the RV8. It's a slightly upgraded MG body shell. It's the same chassis and everything. And they put a 3.9 litre engine in, and they put the headers through the inner fenders. So as soon as that happened in England, we were allowed to race with the headers going through the fenders. So everything on the car that you see, it's written for the British rules in England. And the real upgrades come from factory, mostly race cars, you know, that they improved over the years.
How wide are the wheels on your car?
Well, that's the other thing. So in the BC V8 Championship, we were allowed to run 11-inch wide slicks. And I'd run 10-inch wide in England, but I very quickly brought the car to America. So I hardly ever used them. So I had these 16-inch by 10-inch wide wheels sitting around forever. When I brought the car to America, you may remember, to race in vintage, I had to make some changes similar to the SCCA regulations. So I was only allowed to run 8-inch wide wheels. So when I've made this upgrade to race in a different class with HSR, one of the things I'm allowed to do is run with the wider wheels. So it's got 10-inch 15s and 10-inch 16s. I have two different sizes. And, they fill out the wheel arches very nicely.
What type of wheels are those, by the way? What's the brand?
Well, they're a very old, traditional brand. Remember, I've had these wheels, 35 years. They're called Revolutions.
Uh-huh.
And you see them on various cars, you know, from time to time. But I'm guessing you can still buy them. I don't know that. But anybody who knows, they know, oh, yeah, that's a Revolution wheel. They race them on Formula Fords.
I was just going to say that they look exactly like those. Yeah. All right, so you've got discs on the front and I presume discs on the rear, correct? How big in diameter are they? Disc brakes.
Well, discs on the rear now. Well, up until a year ago, I had to run drum brakes because one of the things the factory never did was put disc brakes on the back of an MGB. Stay in line with the SCCA rules. You know, I had to run drum brakes on the back. But now, so I've got 11 1/4 inch, I think they're an inch wide, vented discs on the front, Wilwood four-pot calipers, and my own combination of disc brakes on the back, which I've made up. Obviously, they're smaller than the front ones. Yeah, the car, it stops pretty good. In fact, years ago, I remember a renowned SCCA racer. He raced a Lotus 11, a little very quick British sports car. And I met him in somebody else's trailer. You know, I knew who he was, very respected race car driver. And we were talking about him and his car, and then it all went quiet. And then he said, so what do you race? And I said, well, I'm not in your class. I said, you know, I have quite an unusual car. So it's just an MGB GT V8. He said, the green one? And I said, yes, yeah, it's green. He said, oh, you're that guy. And I thought, oh, no, did I cut him off or something? And he said, I can't believe how far in the corners you drive that car. You know, and he's got this little lightweight Lotus.
Uh-huh.
And
in other words, you go real deep and brake late. Is that what he's saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
I learned that from stock car racing. Learned how to utilize the brake, get the best out of the brakes. I had a lot of help over the years. I did it when I came here because I didn't have a race car. And back in the day, Saturday night roundy stock car racing wasn't that expensive. We're going back a long time. And I mean, it did get more and more expensive. And I think that's probably why a lot of the tracks have closed down, because, you know, the general guy in the street just couldn't afford to compete with people who had a lot of money. But I learned such a lot from stock car racing, especially in the corners, how to set the car up. Because in a stock car, if you haven't got the car set up, you know, the tires aren't working right, or the shock absorbers especially, the guy behind you, he's just going to run you in the wall. And it's not so intentional, you know, sometimes it is. But often it's because if he puts his brakes on, the guy behind him is going to run him in the wall. So I learned a lot that when I got my car over here from England, for me, it was terrible. I couldn't drive it. And so I used the knowledge I'd got from stock car racing, even though we only turn left in stock car racing. And I used that knowledge and really improved. I certainly improved. My driving improved, or the car improved. And that's really what I enjoy about it. And that's what I enjoyed, you know, with my sailing. One of the things you and I talked about was there are so many comparisons, you know, between people who sail and people who race cars. Over the years, I've met many, many people who, if they're sailors, they race cars, or if they race cars, you know, they're sailors. You know, one of the probably most prominent people that race cars and sailed back in the day was Briggs Cunningham. He raced at Le Mans, had his own cars built and everything. Not a lot of your listeners know, he also won the biggest trophy, the longest standing sports trophy in the world, the America's Cup. You know, in sailing terms, that's probably the biggest event in the world. It's certainly one of the most costly.
Let's jump into your Olympic background. Tell us a little bit how you got involved in sailing and then how you managed to get into the Olympics. and how that story took place.
Well, very interesting. From when I was 7 years old, I don't know where it came from, I wanted to race cars. I knew nobody that raced cars. I didn't know any dads that raced cars or nothing. But I saw a little advert in a comic called The Beano back in England. It was just a boys' comic. And it was an advert for a Scalextrix, electric slot car racing.
Mm-hmm.
I know you have something similar over here.
Yep.
And that got my interest. And eventually I got one as a Christmas present. And from that time on, my whole interest was car racing. So, but the question was, how did I get into sailing? Well, my dad sailed a little. He was in the Royal Air Force, and they often had a sailing club, and you know, he would go sailing, and I might go with him sometimes. But when I was about 14, it was obvious I wasn't going to be able to afford to go car racing. And so I joined a local sailing club, just a little pond. It was actually an old coal hole back in the day when they had steam engines. They'd keep the coal, you know, at the station and in one place. And this was a filled-in coal hole, so it wasn't very big. But it was local, and I started sailing. And anyway, eventually I joined a much improved sailing club on the coast and did a bit of sailing. And like most people, enjoyed it, spent even more time at it. And then my interest peaked. It's like, well, I wonder why those people are so good at it. And so I asked a guy if he would take me out sailing. He was a top sailor, just come back from the World Championships in Canada, done really well. And he took me out, and then he asked me would I sail with him the following season. And I realized I didn't have the knowledge, so I worked at my fitness. People might not really, you know, sailing isn't about sitting down in the bar and having a lot of beers. The top guys tend not to do that so much. But physical fitness is huge. You're out on the water for 8-10 hours a day, or if it's overnight racing, you might be out there for 3 or 4 days, or you know, going around the world, that's even more endurance. So anyway, to be honest, the first time somebody came to the sailing club to do a talk, they just got back from the Olympics and they were going to do a talk on the Olympics. I remember a friend of mine saying, hey, why don't you come and listen to so-and-so? They're doing a talk on the Olympics. And I remember thinking, that's not for me. I'll never be an Olympian. I'm not going to waste my time and go. I was about 19, I guess. 3 years later, I'm at the Olympics, or qualified for the Olympics. So my point there is, anybody who's listening, you just don't know what's around the corner. And so I started, you know, I got very keen on sailing. I saw an advert. There was an advert in a sailing magazine said, hey, if you're interested in crewing, you know, that's not steering the boat, that's being at the front, handling the sails and things. We're looking for people that would come and sail with some ex-Olympians because we're looking for crews. And I went along and sailed with these ex-Olympians, and then one of them said, hey, what are you doing next season? Would you, you know, like to come and sail with me? And that's how I got in it. 2 years later, I qualified for the Olympics and really never looked back. The first Olympics I qualified for was in 1980. Now, if any of you listeners are old enough, they'll remember in 1980, Russia invaded Afghanistan, and England and the USA decided they weren't going to send their athletes to the Olympics. And I was one of those that didn't go to the Olympics. Even though we qualified, we weren't allowed to go. But I stuck with it. 4 years later, I was with another combination, you know, team, and we qualified and went to the Olympics in LA, actually. It was the LA Olympics in 1984. Finished fourth, didn't quite make the medals, but, you know, it was quite the experience. And then again, I went in 1988. So spent quite a lot of time doing that. And then during that time, I pretty much became a professional, you know, yacht racer and raced all over the world. Back in the day, people didn't really know, I don't think, that there was many series where, you know, there were professional sailors. There probably weren't so many from each country, but there were a handful. And America, I mean, they had some really great sailors. Obviously, Dennis Conner was one of them. And, you know, I was fortunate enough. Again, the America's Cup is, you know, that's quite a big event for sailing. It's one of those events. It's like, no, I'll never be one of those guys. You know, it was a very small club, if you like, to get into America's Cup sailing. But England went through a bit of a transformation, and with their America's Cup program, one day one of the guys, the tactician from the team. I just happened to be in a bar after a race one day, and he came over and said, actually, he didn't ask me to do the America's Cup. He said, hey, Jerry. And I knew them, but never spoken to him. His name was Harold Cudmore, fantastic sailor. And he said, come over, I'll buy you a drink. And so I went over, and he said, all he said was, well, we've been talking about you, and could you be in Australia at Christmas? And that's all he said. He didn't say, well, we're thinking about, you know, would you like to come and do the America's Cup? He just said, can you be in Australia? Because the America's Cup had been lost by the Americans. Dennis Connor, unfortunately, was beaten by a far superior boat from Australia. And so that's where the America's Cup was going to be held. Anyway, so I ended up doing the America's Cup, and then, you know, raced in all sorts of events. That's a great life. It really is. But it's so similar to car racing, just adjusting the boat. It's, you're 100% focused for the race. You know, if it's a longer race, 2 or 3 days, yeah, you take a bit of a break, an hour here, an hour there, maybe, if you're lucky. But you're continually adjusting the car. You know, as an example, if a car's understeering, oversteering, or pushing, whatever you'd like to refer it to, a boat has a similar situation where, say, you're tracking along and you're pointing at 12 o'clock and the boat wants to skew up to 1 o'clock or come, what we say, come down to 11 o'clock. So it's oscillating between then. Well, we have to make an adjustment on the boat. We either drop the mast back, adjust the sails, adjust the weight in the boat, you know, with the people on the boat. You know, in the car, you'll deal with the springs or the sway bar. So we're always thinking, how can we improve the boat? And then once the boat's set up, you know, right for that condition, well, the conditions change. Just like on a racetrack, when the sun comes out, you know, things change. When it starts raining, things change. Well, on a sailboat, you're dealing with, you know, the undulating water the whole time. The water is always changing, the wave height, the wind is changing, the wind strength, not only the strength, but, you know, how dense the air is. One of the things I've noticed when the Americans come over, and a lot of them train on the West Coast or in Florida, and I think it would be fair to say that the winds, when it's blowing 20 knots in Florida or LA or something, it's not quite the same as when it's blowing 20 knots in England. The wind, you know, there's more water in the wind, so it's more dense. So when the Americans would come over, I was always impressed. Oh, we're out there sailing and it's blowing 20 knots, 25 knots. And I'm thinking, oh my God, they're so good. Well, when they got to England and they were racing in 20 and 25 knots, it was a whole different situation because it's just different. And the same with cars. You know, you jump in a Porsche and it drives one way, or, you know, you jump into a Mustang and it drives another way. So we're always having to adapt. And like I mentioned earlier, so many car racers sail and vice versa. Had the opportunity one afternoon to race with Christian Fittipaldi. And he was very keen to race single-handed around the world. There's some pretty interesting racing goes on. And he had a sailboat he was looking after that I had interest. I was going to go to England to race a similar boat. So I just wanted to see one before I took the trip over there to race. And Christian was looking after it down in Miami. And so I called him up. Well, you know, I didn't know him. And we went sailing for the afternoon. And he was telling me about his ambition with sailing. You know, obviously he's a top race car driver. But that's just the situation where you meet these people and you just have similar aspirations, and it's always about winning. That's one thing. You know, you can say, oh yeah, I really enjoy it and this, that and the other, but at the end of the day, you can tell everybody wants to absolutely do their best, like-minded people.
I want to go back to the America's Cup. Okay, so when you went to Australia, just for our listeners, if I recall, the way the America's Cup works is whoever the winner is, so for example, in this case it was Australia, the race will start in their country. So if England wins, we start in England. If the United States, because I know Dennis Connor used to race out of San Diego, if I remember correctly, because we used to watch that back in the day. Like you said, he lost it 1 year, and then he won it back the following year. And you were on a boat in that particular race. What was that race like? What was your actual job description, if you will, or your function on the boat as a sailor?
Right. Well, the America's Cup's actually run every 4 years.
Okay.
And when Dennis was beaten, I mean, he is a great sailor, and he was beaten by a better boat. I mean, maybe the crew were better as well. Who knows? But it was the era of a thing called the winged keel, and the Australians persisted with this winged keel. So instead of the keel just sitting straight down, you know, to keep the boat balanced upright, it had wings on the bottom, and a lot of boats, you know, went to that. Certainly at the next America's Cup in Perth, Australia, or Fremantle, Australia, we all had winged keels. So my job, obviously, it's like car racing, it's a team effort. And one guy gets all the credit. That's the guy who steers the boat. They're called the helmsman, but like, you know, the driver in a race car. But at the end of the day, even the helmsman, he knows he's not winning the race without a lot of help. And America's Cup situation, the shore crew, you know, who look after the boats and everything, they're just as important as the people who are actually sailing on the boats. So my position was, I'm what's called a sail trimmer. So I was, and on the America's Cup boats back in the day, sail trimmer, you probably had one sail trimmer on one side of the boat and one sail trimmer on the other side of the boat. And so I was the port sail trimmer. So I had my own little cockpit with a 2-foot diameter winch, which is pretty big. And that's driven by four huge guys who are turning the handles, and it's, you know, turning your winch. And then what a lot of people don't realize on these boats, there's so many ropes and or sheets and control lines that we actually have foot pedals in the cockpit, because you don't have enough hands to lock the ropes off, switch ropes from one rope to another. So, you know, there's quite a lot going on that you can't see from the outside. When you're on the inside of the boat, well, then you realize, because there's the noise and the creaking and the screeching of lines. And back in the day when I did the America's Cup, a lot of the sheets, they're called the ropes that control the sails, were actually steel lines.
Oh.
Because back in the day, the rope weren't strong enough, whereas nowadays, rope can be easily as strong as any steel line. So there was some danger. You know, I got knocked out once by a line, you know, by the steel cord hitting me across the head, and that can happen. But anyway, my job was really a little bit of the boat speed, keeping the boat going fast, adjusting, trimming the sails, which you're doing all the time. Sail is pulled in, but every time you punch into a wave, you'll just ease it a little, just a fraction, and back in and ease it again and back in. So there's a lot going on. Physical fitness, you can't train, or I realized for me, I was one of the smaller guys on the boat, and you can't train hard enough just by going sailing every day. You have to go to the gym, and you have to get stronger and bigger than the job requires. So we spent a lot of time in the gym. You have to eat right, you know, make sure you're bulking up, because when you're on the water for 6-8 hours a day. And down in Fremantle, the America's Cup was sailed for years in Newport, Rhode Island. When it was lost to Australia, it was being sailed in Newport, Rhode Island. And if I'm correct, they would cancel the racing at 20 knots of wind, which the Americans, you know, they made the rules. Well, in Fremantle, we hardly ever started a race in less than 20 knots. Generally, the races started at 18 knots. And by the time some of the races were finished, it was blowing over 30. And that's a lot of wind, especially for a big boat, like what's called a 12 meter. But so my thing was really boat speed. As the years went on, I guess I became a bit more proficient in boat speed. And so I would go and sail with various owners or teams. And my thing was to help make the boat go fast.
How many people were on the crew as a rule?
Okay, well, on the America's Cup boat that I raced, there were 14. And, you know, one guy steers, there's a tactician, there's a main sheet trimmer, four grinders, they're called, four guys that, you know, they've turned the handles, that turn the winches. There's a guy up on the pointy end, the bowman. That's a tough job. And there's a guy in the pit, the trimmers. You know, we all have something to do. And at times, there aren't enough hands to do all the jobs. When we're changing sails, you know, sails are going up, sails are coming down. They have to be pulled on board. It's an exciting time. A bit like, I guess, changing tires on a Formula One car. know, when they're doing it in 1.9 seconds now. It's crazy.
We have a few more minutes left. Tell us a little bit about safety equipment back then, and let's say, what do they have today?
Well, I got to be honest, safety wasn't really a consideration. Back in the day, you know, we wouldn't be checked so much for safety. Yeah, there had to be a life jacket for everybody on board, but that was pretty much it. You know, again, you know, we've lost many sailors over the years, like we lose race car drivers. In 1979, I was doing my Olympic thing, and I was over in Holland, and there's a race called, well, it's called the Admiral's Cup, and America always sends, it's a three-boat team. They're between 40 and 50 feet. Ted Turner was always a very serious competitor at the Admiral's Cup, and in 1979, he actually won the race in his boat called Tenacious. But in 1979, he was ahead of the storm. They had 60-foot waves. I'm not sure what the top wind strength was, but I think it was in excess of 100 miles an hour. Six boats were lost, sank, and this is a 610-mile race up to a rock off Southern Ireland. It's called the Fastnet Rock.
So this is the North Sea then, basically, or is this in the British Canal?
Not North Sea, the Atlantic.
The Atlantic,
okay. The Atlantic Ocean, yeah. So we're out in the Atlantic for a bit, you know, 100 miles offshore, off England or whatever, up around the Fastnet Rock and back. And six boats were lost. 19 sailors lost their lives.
Oh, my.
I mean, it was a terrible situation. But the boats were just getting rolled over. I mean, there was nothing a lot of them could do. The boats would just get rolled over in the big seas. I mean, 60-foot seas is huge. I've certainly never been out in anything that big. And, there is a little side story to this real quick. So that was in 1979. Terrible situation. Yes, safety was upgraded. Life rafts were upgraded. Life jackets were upgraded. You know, we have self-inflating life jackets now. So a lot of things went on. You had to have somebody on board who could cope with some medical situations. They didn't have to be a doctor, but they had to pass some tests. So there were a lot of upgrades. So in 1979, a gentleman I got to know later on, he was a top navigator, and he was a navigator on one of these boats in 1979. He got rescued. The boat sank, but he was rescued by one of the helicopters. I mean, the helicopters did a fantastic job. I think they had like 40 helicopters, you know, from the Royal Air Force and the Navy trying to find these people. Anyway, he got rescued. And the reason I'm telling you this story, in 1989, I was racing in this event called the Admiral's Cup on a British boat. And he was our navigator. And we were about to go. It's a series of races over a week. And the final race is, so it's a series of short races, you know, day races. And the final race is the Fastnet, which is a 3 or 4 day race, depending on the weather condition. And he comes down the dock the day before the Fastnet, smile on his face. A fisherman they'd pulled up his wallet in their fishing nets in the Atlantic Ocean, and they'd sent it back to him.
No kidding.
And quite the story. And as I say, you know, we do lose friends and people over the years, just some stupid accidents or gear failure sometimes, you know, boat sinking as well. But it's a wonderful sport. You meet so many people, you know, you have so many friends. I don't know if we've got time for another quick story about sailing and Derek Bell.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Le Mans 24-hour winner. So I used to go to the local racetracks. The one was called Thruxton in England. And back in the early 70s, Formula 2 was quite a popular race car sport. And all the Formula 1 drivers in England would race Formula 2. And they would come to this track at Thruxton. Graham Hill, Jackie Stewart, Jochen Rindt, all my favorite guys back then. And Derek Bell was one of those drivers. And I had an autograph book, and, you know, I'd get all the autographs. Well, I went to Sebring. It was a support race for the 12 hours of Sebring. And the racing was being run by SCRA, the vintage sports car people. Anyway, Derek Bell was there, and he was managing the Volvo sedan team. The Volvos were racing, not in the 12 hours of Sebring. And I had this book with me. I just happened to have it in the motorhome. And I said to my wife, Mary, I said, let's go over and see Derek Bell. I say, I've got this book here. It's got his autograph in. But not only that, Derek Bell one day came to a big event in England and he sailed with us on the America's Cup boat.
Oh, wow.
On the 12-meter America's Cup boat. And I remember him. He was like a kid in a candy store. Super nice guy. And he was all over the boat with his video camera and came up on to the pointy end, the bow. And I happened to be up there with another friend of mine. And we both got back from Australia, having done the America's Cup. And he comes up there and he says, what do you do on the boat? And, you know, we said, well, this is what we do, you know. And he says, oh, did you do the America's Cup? And yes, we did the America's Cup. Well, we have a little thing that we used to do. We used to see lots of celebrities down in Australia, cricketers and pop stars, and they'd all come to the, if they were British, they'd come along to the team and have a drink with us and things. And when they'd come in, if they came into the bar and they'd come in and they'd be looking and they might have seen somebody on the TV that they recognized, one of the sailors, and they'd say, oh, I know you, you're, we had one guy especially called Jabba. Ah, you're Jabba. And Jabba would always turn to them and say, he knew who they were. And he'd say, well, yes, yes, I'm Jabba. And you are? And they would just stop dead in their tracks, humble as they were, and then have to explain, well, you know, I'm so-and-so the cricketer. And of course, we knew who you were. Well, we did that to Derek Bell. Derek Bell's up on the bow, and he comes up there and says, what do you do? And this, that, and the other. And my friend says to him, yes, and what do you do? And he was just so taken back. He was just very humble. And he said, well, I race cars. But anyway, then we joked about it. So I'm at Sebring. We go over to the Volvo thing and Derek's there talking to some people. And one of his mechanics comes up and says, can I help you? And I said, I've got a book here with Derek Bell's autograph from like the 1970s. And I've got a little story I'd like to share with him. And so he said, oh, well, wait here. And when Derek's free, you know, I'll call you over. So we just waited a few minutes, called us over. And I said, you know, hello, Mr. Bell. Just wanted to share a story with you. And by the way, I have your autograph here from when you raced at Thruxton in 1972. Oh, yes, he said. Oh, yes, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's my autograph. Yeah, oh, I remember those days. And he was really nice. And I said, well, actually, back in the 80s, you actually came sailing with a gentleman. The owner was called Peter de Savary. With Peter de Savary on his tour. Oh, yes, he said, yes, I remember. I remember that. It was a great day, you know, and he got all excited. And then he said to me, and he said, so were you one of the America's Cup racers? And I said, well, actually, yes, I was. And he announced it to the whole team. I was so embarrassed. He said, guys, this guy Jerry here, he's from the America's Cup racing. And so I just felt like in some way he got his own back on me. He wasn't doing anything intentionally, but he was excited and, you know, a fun story to share. And then I saw him about 2 months later at the Walter Mitty up at Road Atlanta, and he was a guest, you know, of the race. And as I walked in, I walked up and I just, you know, acknowledged him as I walked past him, and he looked at me, acknowledged me, and I just said, I'm the America's Cup sailor. And he said, oh, yes, 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 I remember. So fun stories.
Well, we are up against the clock. Jerry, I want to thank you very much for hanging out with us here at Nostalgic Radio and Cars. We didn't get to cover this, but the next time we'll have you on, you know, maybe down the road a little ways, but we want to talk a little bit about the J24, and you got some good stories there, and there's a connection there to Clearwater. We'll get into that. But in the meantime, I thank you again for hanging out with us here at Nostalgic Radio and Cars, and I wish you all the best, and look forward to see you to the next vintage race.
Yeah, I look forward to that, Robert. You know, I'm going to do the Mitty again next year and a few other races, and, you know, I'm sure you'll be around, so look forward to catching up. It's been a real pleasure.
Super. Do you go to the Sebring races and then to Daytona as well?
I have been. I'm not making any plans at the moment. I've got my engine pulled out. After the Mitty, I pulled it out to have some special heads put on it. And the way the whole world's going at the moment, you know, parts and things, you just can't guarantee anything. But yeah, I'm planning to. I was, in fact, at Daytona, real quick, we talked about Briggs Cunningham. And at Daytona, at the HSR race later this year, you know, they do a 24-hour version.
Right.
They're not racing for 24 hours. But Briggs Cunningham built, without being rude, probably one of the ugliest cars ever produced.
Yeah. I know which one you're talking about. Right.
And a gentleman called Derek Drinkwater, he built a copy of it. It's based on a 1949-1950 Cadillac.
Right.
And Briggs Cunningham raced it at Le Mans. It did finish. It finished 11th overall, but it got the nickname from the French, Le Monster. It wasn't the best looking car. But apparently Derek Drinkwater's bringing it to the HSR race at Daytona. It's October the 30th. And I think they're going to run it in the classic 24 hours there, which is, you know, cars run for 24 hours, but your actual race probably lasts 45 minutes to an hour. And you're out every 2 or 3 hours. But I think they're planning to race that Le Monster in that 24-hour race at Daytona.
Well, we will be there, and we'll see you there. So, Jerry, yep. Thanks again, and keep in touch. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Robert.
Okay. Bye-bye. Have a good one. Okay, listeners, thank you for tuning in to Nostalgic Radio and Cars this evening. Don't forget to check us out here every Tuesday between 7 and 8 p.m. on the Tantalk Radio Network, where you can listen to interviews with some of the most fascinating and legendary names in motorsports, music, and now sailing. Don't forget to follow us on social media, like and share. And I want to see some of you guys. You know, summer's around the corner. See you guys in your boats, definitely in the cars, and on your motorcycles. And in the meantime, stay safe, drive carefully, and love your family.
You know, the day destroys the night. Night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah. Chased our pleasures here, dug our treasures there.